Welcome to the Unsweetened SIO podcast. My name is Siobhan Harris. I am a certified integrative nutrition health coach and the founder of unsweetenedsio.com. I gave up all sugar and all flour on January 13th, 2018, and am finally free of my addiction. My mission is to help other sugar addicts find their path to freedom and live the sweet life without sugar. Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 144 of Unsweetened SIO, the podcast. Today, I'm really excited to welcome back guest Susan Pierce Thompson. Susan is an adjunct associate professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the University of Rochester and an expert in the psychology of eating. She is president of the Institute for Sustainable Weight Loss and the founder of the worldwide Bright Line Eating Movement. Her first two books, including Bright Line Eating, The Science of Living Happy, Thin, and Free, became New York Times bestsellers and instant Hay House favorites. Her work weaves the neuroscience of food addiction with powerful insights from positive psychology, IFS, and 12-step recovery to outline a roadmap for achieving true integrity and self-authorship around food. The Bright Line Eating mission is to help 1 million people around the globe discover lasting food freedom and have their bright transformations by 2025. Today, though, we're going to be talking about her latest book, which is called Resume, The Powerful Reframe to End the Crash and Burn Cycle of Food Addiction. So welcome back, Susan.
Thanks, Siobhan. It's so great to be here with you again.
It's been almost 2 years, we were realizing. June 2020 is the first episode that we did. And if you haven't listened to that, I implore you to listen to that episode first. It will give you such a good foundation for this conversation. I will link it in the show notes. It's episode 60. And she really goes into your own powerful story. It's just incredible that what you've been through and where you are now. So please listen to that first, but I'm so excited to talk about Resume. So tell us a little bit about what made you write this book.
Yeah, this book came out of, again, more pain. I seem to always do my best work coming out of a lot of personal struggle and pain. In short, after, you know, going through my own struggles with drug addiction and then food addiction and then getting clean and sober and, you know, my weight climbing up to obesity and finally losing all my excess weight 18 years ago and then becoming a professor and founding Bright Line Eating and so forth. I founded Bright Line Eating with about 10 or 11 back-to-back years of real sort of stability and peace with my food under my belt. And Bright Line Eating took off so fast and so fiercely that, you know, I had 3 little kids. They were 6 and 6 and 2-ish, you know, 6 and 6 and 3 when I first started Bright Line Eating. And, you know, within a year and a half or so, I had my first break in my own Bright Lines in a long, long time. And then with the travel that I was starting to do and just the load on my plate, the juggling, all the spinning plates, I found it hard to sink back into consecutive, peaceful Bright Lines. And so that started about 4 years of sort of on again and off again with my Bright Lines. And it was painful and it was hard. And what, you know, something I say in the book Resume is that there was this sort of pressurized laboratory where on the one hand, my food addiction was reawakened and, you know, my brain was absolutely not peaceful again. It was craving, you know, sugar and flour. It was craving more quantities. It was craving food outside of mealtimes. It was, you know, thumping hard for me to break my Bright Lines. And then on the other hand, I needed to maintain a healthy, right-sized body in order to go on camera on a weekly basis, shooting a weekly vlog, doing podcast interviews, appearing at conferences and so forth. And also I kept being on camera, giving voice to a journey of recovery and food freedom, you know, through the Bright Lines. And those two forces pressing in on each other created, I think, just an accelerated learning environment where, you know, I practiced and sort of explored getting back on track over and over again. I couldn't really do what I'd done in the past, which was just let it all go for a while and eat, you know, in the, without having to be the leader of Bright Line Eating at that time, I just would have put on 50 pounds or 100 pounds or whatever, and just eaten my way up the scale and then thought about it in a few years, you know, but I couldn't think about it in a few years. I had to be on camera on Thursday, you know, like, so basically the book came out of that time. You know, I did finally put down the food in September of 2019, you know, and I'm back consecutively bright now for, you know, years, whatever that is, 2.5 years ish. And I'm super grateful for that. But I really think that there are invaluable lessons that I got out of that time. And I think I came, you know, ultimately, I think I came out of that journey with a more self-led program, which I talk, I define that term in the book. And I'm sure we'll get into all that. But that's basically where the book came from. I ended up creating a course first called Reboot Resume, which is available in the all access membership for Bright Line Eating. It's an incredibly powerful course for people who want to get back on track, and also really for people who just want to take their recovery to the next level, who have been bright or had their food kind of in place for a long time and really want to up level their journey. It's just a really deep process to learn how to, you know, surf that resume sine wave. And I'm sure we'll talk about that as well, but that's where it comes from. A lot of pain, a lot of practice, a lot of exploration. Yeah.
Well, and I think so many people relate to this struggle, and I think they hear, oh, wow, you even, you know, had breaks. Like, I think we are ashamed of that. First, we're ashamed of our binge, you know, eating and food addiction, and then we find recovery, but then we might slip or have these breaks, and then we're kind of ashamed about that, you know. And I just really appreciate your vulnerability and sharing your own struggle, because I think, again, that's going to resonate with so many people that really need this program, right? Because it's not perfection. Like, this is definitely a journey, and there's going to be a lot of learning experiences. And if you can kind of reframe it that way, you're able to kind of get back on track a lot faster, which is, you know, what you cover in the book. So I also would like to introduce that concept, because the other huge part of this book is the concept of IFS, and you kind of, you know, have a co-author on this. So talk to us a little bit about that for people that aren't familiar at all with what that is, because this is so beautifully interwoven with the book. So talk about that.
Yeah. So my co-author for this book is Everett Considine, and Everett Considine is a very, very skilled IFS practitioner and coach, and a level 3 practitioner. So IFS stands for Internal Family Systems, and it's a branch of psychology. It was founded by Richard Schwartz, who's a professor. In the 1980s, he was working with patients with bulimia, and he was a family systems therapist. Now that's different. Family systems therapy is like, you know, looking at things like birth order and that, the impact of that on development, and also just looking at the family dynamic, right? Often in a family, you know, one kid is the peacekeeper and one kid is the sort of scapegoat, right? Or the instigator, right? And so there's these family dynamics. And as people go into some sort of treatment or recovery, whether it's drug and alcohol, or in this case, bulimia, a family systems therapist will bring the family in for family therapy and really sort of look at that patient in the context of their family ecosystem. Well, Dick Schwartz did a clinical trial looking at the effectiveness of that family systems therapy, and he found no effect. It was not helping at all. These patients were having just as many binge purge episodes, and he was blown away. He was like, how can that be? You know, we're doing all this great therapy with their families and with them. So he brought his clients, his patients, one by one in to interview them, because he really was curious at that point, you know, how it could be that this wasn't working. And as he interviewed these patients, he heard them talking about the part of them that would binge and the part of them would hold on and restrict and avoid the binge. And then the part of them that would give in and the part that would come out and help them reach this sort of high oblivion state. And then the part that could go long periods without binging at all. And he said to himself, oh my gosh, it seems like they have a family system inside of them. Like they've got parts of them inside at war with each other. You know, the part that wants to binge, the part that's trying to control the food environment and say, no, we're not going to binge, we're going to lose our weight, et cetera. And so that's where the name comes from, internal family systems. And internal family systems is one of the latest, because there's several modalities now in psychology that deal with parts. This, I think, is the most fleshed out, it's the most mature, it's the most evidence-based, but it's one of the approaches that talks about the human psyche as being comprised of a collection of parts. And Dick Schwartz has a book where he outlines the history of this perspective, and it's fascinating. It goes back all the way to ancient Egypt. We actually have a tomb with hieroglyphics on it that describe this man's battle with himself. So he is arguing with his soul, and he's saying, I want to commit suicide. I want to kill myself. Commit suicide isn't the right term, but I want to take my life, right? And the soul is saying, no, you mustn't. And he's having this argument with himself, and he's saying, well, how about this one part is saying, well, how about if we have a lot of gold and a really fancy burial with a lot of gold? And the soul is saying, no, even then you cannot take your own life. And at the end of this long dialogue in the hieroglyphics, you know, the soul and the part that wanted to die came to an agreement and reached some resolution. So anyway, it goes all the way back there, but Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates were all big believers in the parts perspective. Socrates, I think, said it best, and anyone who's ever struggled with their food will relate to this quote. Socrates said, one mind cannot both want and not want at the same time. Therefore, we are all at least two. And so the parts perspective really got fleshed out by Everett Considine in the context of an eating journey by recognizing the archetypes of the food indulger and the food controller who are at war with each other, right? And understanding the other parts that are often in play as well, the isolator, the caretaker, the rebel, right? So oftentimes there's a rebel part that just rebels against a recovery abstinence framework at all and so forth. But let me just take a breath, and I just want to step back, if I may, and just say the internal family systems perspective on the human psyche is the most helpful, just the most helpful, and I think the most accurate and authentic take on the human psyche that I've ever encountered. So let me just outline a couple more of the features of this approach, because I think it really, it's a game changer to, you know, as someone who taught psychology at colleges and universities around the world for 16 years, let me just say, there is no other conception of the human psyche that I've ever come across that has as much utility and functional application. So basically what IFS teaches is that each of us has an authentic self, a highest self. Now, this is not a part. This is who we truly are. And we know that we're in our highest self, we're operating from a place of authentic highest self when we're manifesting the eight C's. And they are when we're clear, when we're calm, when we're compassionate, when we're confident, when we're connected, when we're courageous, when we're curious, and Oh, I think I missed one. Curious and creative. Did I say create? I think creative is the eighth one. So those are the eight C's. So you can feel what that feels like, right? When you're calm, clear, connected, compassionate, creative, confident. That's how you are when you're in your highest self. You're being you, right? Now, when you're anything else, right? Agitated, angry, fearful, any of those things, you're in a part. You're operating, you're blended, as they say, with a part of you. And parts come in two types. We've got protective parts and we've got wounded parts. So protective parts have the job of protecting the wounded parts, right? And so when we get hurt, we have protective sides of us that come out, right? To defend or to argue or to whatever it is, right? To deflect, to caretake, right? So some protective parts have the job of trying to get ahead of our wounding. They're trying to manage things so that we don't get hurt, right? And they might have really interesting strategies. Like an inner critic part is a manager of sorts. It's trying to shame us and blame us and, you know, whip us into shape so that we will be fit for the world, to not be criticized, to fit in, to be worthy of love and affection, right? So that's actually the role of an inner critic part. It's misguided in its strategy, really, but it's trying to help. You know, all this sort of inner negative self-talk really is of the aim of like, let's get it together so we don't get hurt by the world anymore, right? Let's shape it up. and there's other ways to sort of have a manager strategy, which would be caretaking, right? If we just do for others all the time, then we will hopefully be beyond reproach. Hopefully we will be accepted. Hopefully we will turn the tables well enough to like get love and validation and so forth, right? So this is a strategy that manager parts play. And most of us can also relate to having a food manager, right? A food controller part that's trying to keep us from, it's again, these protective parts are trying to get ahead of our wounding. They're trying to make it so that we're not hurt in the future. And so a food controller has the job, the role inside of our psyche of keeping our food in order so that we'll be at a weight where we feel like we're deserving of love and validation, or so that we won't experience the pain of terrible binges anymore, or so that we will have the peace and the order that we know come from having our food in order. Now, these food controller parts can be very perfectionistic, very rigid. They can be very shaming, or they can be very health promoting. Like, come on, let's eat our spinach, you know, so that we feel good and we know we feel better that way. The other protective parts are the other type of protective parts, not the managers, are the firefighters. These ones swoop in after we've been wounded. And the firefighter parts are often, well, it could be anger, right? If we've been wounded, we might get angry, or we might want to numb, right? So all of the typical, you know, playing video games, eating ice cream, sex and smoking cigarettes and drugs and alcohol and bulimia and all those things, these are firefighter parts. They're looking for numbness and for anesthetization and for treatment for the wounding. You know, again, they're doing their best. These parts, God bless them, they just have typically strategies that might not be adaptive, but they're really trying to help. And that's an amazing insight with IFS, is that all these parts of us are just trying to help. And so, you know, and then all these protective parts are trying to protect the wounded inner children down underneath, right? Who are carrying the burden of our wounds. So what's helpful about this is, first of all, it explains the like really in two minds way that so many of us experience our life. Like sometimes we're like this and sometimes we're like that, especially with our food, right? That's the war between the food indulger and the food controller. And it also, it helps to clarify, otherwise we feel really broken and fractured and sort of like, what's wrong with me that I can one day really be so committed to eating this kind of way, and then the next minute seem to not care at all. Well, that's not all you. Those are different parts, right? You've got that part that definitely has that agenda to keep to that food plan. And then you've got another part that is operating from a whole different framework, right? That has the agenda maybe to inject some fun or to relax a little, or to just that a part that recognizes how stressed out you are and just wants to provide some ease and comfort, you know, and it's offering food as a solution, right? So anyway, as soon as you start to understand a part's perspective, it starts to provide a vocabulary and a set of concepts and categories that really helps to clarify an otherwise very confusing inner landscape that can seem like a big jumble. So that's a long answer, but that is what IFS is. And we've been using IFS and Brightline Eating now for 5, 6, 7 years, really. We have a lot of experience now using IFS to help people achieve, you know, their objectives in terms of food recovery, and to really understand their inner landscape and to have strategies for when these parts start to get involved. We know what to do about it. It's really helpful.
So yeah, this to me, like, and I think so many people, when they hear this, like, yeah, there's different parts of you. It's like, oh yeah, like that makes so much sense. Like you're saying, especially around the food addiction where, yeah, the food controller versus the food indulger. When I was reading all that, I'm like, oh my gosh, like even though I'm over 4 years in recovery now, still just learn that just helped me so much. So at the end of each chapter, you introduce a new part. And then in the appendix, which is so great, there's all these quizzes and stuff to help you kind of dig in even deeper on this IFS work. So, and what I love is this, the IFS, like, just came, I was listening to a parenting podcast and it was someone talking about it, about like how it helps with childhood trauma. And then I listened actually to a podcast episode where Richard Swartz was interviewed and did a little session on someone. It was like a 2-hour episode. And I was just like, this is a fascinating. And then to read your book and have it directed towards the food addiction, I mean, it's just so brilliant. And I think it's going to help so many people, like just combining that together. I was telling Susan before we recorded, I actually reached out to Everett and scheduled some sessions for myself because I am just so curious to dig in a little bit more. So thank you for linking the two together. I just think it's so powerful. So we'll kind of talk a little bit more, like kind of just looking inside the book. We'll give everyone a little peek inside the book here of really your, you know, what resuming is. Well, you can define it if you want for me, but it's just basically helping with relapse. And how would you define it though? That's how I was thinking of it. Like, we don't talk about that part a lot with recovery, I feel like, you know, so to define like resume for us.
Yeah. Well, to resume is to get back on track. And I think that it's really important to note, you know, and the book Resume really makes this point often and strongly, that we don't have to have, you know, eaten a cookie to need to resume, right? It could be that our food hasn't yet fallen apart, but we notice that our habits, our tools, our structures are slipping badly. Maybe we've been traveling, maybe whatever. And resuming might be getting our support and our habit stacks back on track so that we don't actually, you know, go back into the food. And so in an ideal world, you're scanning, always scanning your food, your actions, and your support, and pulling back into an upswing, into a resume mode, which is where you're pulling it all back up together. Like, think of a sine wave that goes up and down in life. It's always going to happen. Life gets lifey, and you're always going to lapse sometimes in various ways. We all know that there's ways that your food can be affected without it being a relapse, you know, where you can be just noticing a lot more food chatter in your mind. You can be hunting in the store for the biggest apple, you know, or you could be really back in the food, you know, absolutely binging your brains out back in the food. And it's a continuum. So we spell resume R-E-Z-O-O-M. To be cute and just sort of signify that you, one of the keys is really to do it fast and to do it well before, ideally, you're binging your brains out. But what happens when you hold to a perfectionistic food controller so tight, when that part is so fearful and holding on to things so tightly is that often any sort of lapse mode is a big binge, because the only way to sort of let some steam out is to go, you usually get a pretty powerful food indulger wresting control out from the hands of that perfectionistic food controller. And it tends not to go well, right? So easing up some of the war between those two parts is a big thing. So anyway, a resume is just getting back on track. And there's a whole universe of gradations when it comes to what that lapse might have looked like. It might not have been an official relapse with the food, or it might.
Which I think is so important to point that out like that, because I have kind of felt like I've lapsed. Didn't go off any my food plan or anything, but since December was kind of struggling. Now I feel resumed and back on track since April. But for me, it looked as I started slipping and you talk about this, having that evening ritual and morning ritual, and that my self-care was slipping. Mm-hmm. You know, that is kind of like the first kind of warning sign. And then I was starting to still like kind of maybe eat more than I normally would, or at times I wouldn't normally, or I realized, I think I'm kind of emotionally eating right now, even though it was all still abstinent food. It can show up in really different ways. And it's almost like that dangerous, like if you can catch it and just be aware of it again with some self-compassion too. It's like, oh, I see what's going on here. And here are the steps I can take to just kind of get back on track. You say a really great quote that you say you use in the Brightline community about being like 2 feet away at any point of falling into the ditch. You know, talk a little bit about that. I love that quote because I really related to that.
Yeah. So a saying that we've had for a long time, and this might have come from a 12-step food program, I'm not sure where I first heard it, but no matter how far down the road you are, you're always still just 2 feet from the ditch. And, you know, for someone like me, who's been in food recovery for 19 years, and I've been clean and sober from drugs and alcohol without a single deviation for 27 years. It's really important to remember I'm one drink away from a drunk, you know, I'm one high away from the crack house, you know, and it is true. Once an addict, always an addict. Neurologically, those fiber tracks are still there. So no matter how far down the road you are, you're always still just 2 feet from the ditch. But then someone in our community pointed out that the converse is also true, that no matter how long you've been sitting in the ditch, you're always still just 2 feet from the road.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love that. Yeah, that's just something I think is so good for people listening. Like this is just part of the recovery, like, and just keeping that in mind. If you do, you know, go off track, there's help there, you know, right away. So talk to us a little bit about, your resume reframe and, you know, kind of what, because this again comes from your own personal experience. And I'm sure working with all the people that you've worked with too, and seeing some of these patterns. So, you know, talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the resume reframe is a way of thinking about the journey that embraces and understands that it's going to go up and down and ebb and flow, right? That there will never be perfection. As much as the food controller wants a world in which there's perfection, it's not possible. It never will happen. It never, ever, ever will happen. It's going to ebb and flow always. And so developing some wisdom and some nuance around those ebbs and flows. The fact that it's going to ebb and flow does not mean that it's all ruined and that real recovery isn't possible. It means that we've got to be a wise steward of ourselves on the journey. It means we've got to see the gray. It's not all black and white. We've got to see the gray on the journey, because as things get a little bit wonkier, we're going to have to recognize that and pull into resume mode faster. So basically, the resume reframe takes a very simplistic, childlike, all or nothing framework around food recovery, that we're either completely abstinent or binging our brains out, that there's nothing in between, that we're going to start off perfect and then either be perfect forever and ever and ever, or at the soonest bobble, we're going to crash and burn into the, you know, hells of the pits of binging our brains out. And then we're going to, you know, wait until we're miserable enough. We're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And then we're going to launch off again, get a new sponsor, maybe launch off on another track of perfection. And that we'll just sort of cross our fingers and toes and hope that that lasts forever perfectly. And until we crash and burn into the danger and destruction zone again. And that's the old way, right? That's the crash and burn cycle. And we do hear people in 12-step recovery rooms talking about their journey in that sort of black and white perfectionistic thing of, I was miserable, I was fat, I was binging my brains out, I found recovery. And then I've just been on a steady, you know, cruise of perfect recovery ever since. I've been abstinent now for umpty decades or years or whatever, and it's been perfect. And not to say that, you know, from the perspective of not having eaten, you know, sugar and flour or whatever, that that's not potentially accurate. Of course it is. There absolutely are people who've been following a food plan, you know, for decades. But what it does is it erases the nuance that certainly has happened. Everyone who's in food recovery has times when their food starts to feel a little bit more wonky. They notice themselves holding on in certain ways, or maybe they do something in a restaurant that doesn't feel quite clean and they talk to their sponsor about it, or maybe they're, you know, attached to that big fruit, or there's all sorts of ways that that manifests. And then of course, there's all the habits and the support structures that support abstinence that get very nuanced as well. Sometimes we're really, you know, Johnny on the spot, just sort of habitual with it all. And other times it feels like it's unraveling a little bit and we need to get back to basics and we need to get our habit stacks rebuilt and sort of set strong again. So what the resume reframe is recognizing that instead of, you know, perfect or just totally messed up, our recovery journey ideally is going to be a gently undulating sine wave of ups and downs and ups and downs, but overall raised well above the danger and destruction zone, so that as we slide down, we can admit to ourselves that we're sliding down, that things are getting wonky and wobbly, that we need to resume, that we need some extra care and attention, that we need to take note that it's time to resume and get on an upswing before we just let it all fall apart, right? And so in psychology, in the psychological literature, there's a phenomenon that's documented and it's called the what the hell effect. And it's basically, okay, I've eaten a piece of pizza, what the hell? I might as well eat the whole pizza and start my diet again on Monday, right? And people with a dieting mentality are very vulnerable to the what the hell effect. And so what the resume reframe is kind of the antidote to the what the hell effect, right? It's like, look, there are gradations and eating one piece of pizza is way better than eating a whole pizza. And that person who ate one piece of pizza, if they had had the resume reframe in mind, they might not have eaten that piece of pizza because they might have noticed that they were on a downswing and lapsing a bit before they ever got to that point, right? So what the book Resume does and what the resume reframe does is it enters a lot of nuance, a lot of wisdom and maturity, a lot of real life, a lot of, you know, gray areas into what wants to be a very black and white discussion, right? And I just got to say, you know, I am not someone who takes any issue with an abstinence approach. This is all within an abstinence framework for the treatment of genuine bona fide addiction. Take it as someone who lived in a crack house, rotating out to the streets to prostitute for the money to smoke more crack. I get that addiction is real and that absolute perfect abstinence is absolutely what we're striving for these wicked addictions. It is, right? I do not want to ever smoke a cigarette again. I do not ever want to eat a donut again. And I do not ever want to smoke crack or snort crystal meth again. These are things that are black and white for me. And with food, because it's so much harder, there is a way in which we've got to understand the gradations in abstinent days, in bright days, right? They're not all created equal. And our food, if we stay open to it, is going to tell us a lot about how we're doing. And we've got to stay open to that nuance in order to become an effective surfer of that sine wave that's always happening, right? So it's not a cut and dried concept, I don't think, but the resume reframe is really important. It's really powerful.
Yeah, you have some really good graphs in the book to kind of show this, you know, up and down and not getting to that destructive zone and how that looks a little bit different for everybody. I love that, you know, like you talk about how everyone, it, just because of our susceptibility, right? I know you test really high on that. I do too. So we're probably going to have to be a little more, you know, aware, but some people can ebb and flow. Their swings might look a little bigger than yours, but I like that too, that the resume journey is different, looks different for everybody as well. Like it's really, this whole book is really checking in with yourself, getting to know yourself, not trying to do it someone else's way.
Yeah. And, you know, I think in the food addiction recovery world, there's a movement within that world that doesn't like that idea, right? Like if your sponsor doesn't eat grapes, you don't eat grapes. And, you know, it's a very sort of not customized journey. And I'm a big believer of sort of, you know, listen to the inner voice and your higher power and consult with your sponsor. But, you know, I have not had a sponsor who told me what to do or what I could or should weigh or what was a break for me in a long time. And I also understand that there is a place for a very sort of doctrinaire rigid approach to recovery at first for a lot of people. You know, sometimes that is just what is going to make the food controller part of us feel most supported, right? Just to have someone tell us what to do. And yeah, so I get that as well.
But that's another big, you know, part of this that you mentioned in the book too. It can evolve over time too. You might need to start out a certain way, but then again, you can experiment and see like what works for you, you know? And I believe that now, like some of the stuff that I was eating in the beginning of my recovery, I choose not to eat now. Like you do kind of evolve and change, and it's kind of just paying attention to yourself and living. I love this, you know, that concept of your authentic self and having this self-led program, both of these concepts that you talk about in the book, because that to me is what makes it truly sustainable, is when you're really, it's self-led and from your authentic self, not trying to like white knuckle someone else's, you know, way of doing things. So talk to us more about that concept of the self-led program.
Yeah. Well, I imagine a lot of your listeners come from 12-step food recovery. Probably not all, but some. And, you know, I first walked into my first 12-step food meeting back in 1995. God, what is that now? 18? No. How many years ago? 20. God, 26 years ago, whatever it is. Anyway, long time ago. I can't do math. Don't ever ask yourself to do math live in front of a bunch of people. Okay. So, 1995, I went to my first meeting and here's what I believe. Now, I'm just going to sort of go all op-ed here and just give my opinion about a bunch of stuff. I think that there are the archetypes that I talk about in the book Resume, that Everett Considine talks about, are really operating kind of at the level of different 12-step programs as well. So I see in the original 12-step program, Overeaters Anonymous, a lot of food indulger energy, right? There are a lot of, now that fellowship has different enclaves in different locations around the country and around the world, and the program is stronger in certain places than others. But since they removed the distribution of food plans formally and disallowed that, there has been a lot of sort of, I lovingly say, you know, sitting around talking about the cookies we ate last night, right? And not as much food recovery, not as much physical recovery. That varies from place to place. And certainly there are tens of thousands of people who have achieved really magnificent recovery in Overeaters Anonymous. So I don't want to deny that at all. But as a whole, as an organization, there's a lot of food indulger energy there of like, trying different food plans and see if you can have the, you know, brown flour instead of white flour, or doing the artificial sweetener experiment, or blah, 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 right? And then there are all these 12-step food programs that have broken off from Overeaters Anonymous, with subgroups of people who had really strong recovery back when there were food plans distributed in Overeaters Anonymous, and who wanted to hold on to their food plan, thank you very much, and to be able to distribute them to newcomers with the thinking of like, you know, if we don't tell them what the first addictive bite is, how are they going to get abstinent, right? We've got to distribute food plans. And so, you know, there's a ton of these programs, maybe half a dozen of them or so with significant membership. And overall, on average, I see a food controller energy really dominating in those programs, right? A fear base, a gripping, and a like, you know, you have to eat this way. Otherwise it's, you know, you're going to, you know, suffer and tumble back into your addiction. Now, again, as someone who believes in an abstinence approach, I don't think there's anything inherently controlling at all about an abstinence approach. As a matter of fact, I think from a really highest self perspective, a lot of us come to an abstinence decision very authentically, right? Like I have one for cigarettes. I should not ever smoke a cigarette. When I smoke a cigarette, I smoke a pack of cigarettes, and then I'm sneaking and hiding and lying around my family, and it's just bad news. Zero cigarettes is absolutely the goal for me, right? And I'm not gripping that in any way, shape, or form. I hold that very loosely and almost humorously, but it is my objective, is to not ever smoke a cigarette. So a self-led program is when you are honoring the boundaries, bright lines, abstinence that really make sense in honest light of your experience and the neuroscience around genuine food addiction, right? And it's also where you are getting enough support so that the food controller part of you that is probably going to do a lot of the heavy lifting to operate your program. And that's fair. That's fine. That food controller part is ready to do its work, right? And that part needs some support. But if you're operating a self-led program, for example, I'll just give some examples here because I think it'll help people to understand what I mean. If you've written down and committed that your dinner is going to be, you know, this many ounces of grilled chicken and this many ounces of steamed peppers and onions and this ounces of salad and so forth, right? That's your dinner. And then your two-year-old develops an ear infection and you spend, you know, late into the evening with them at urgent care. And you get home at 8 o'clock at night, you know, and suddenly realizing that slicing peppers and onions and firing up the grill to make chicken doesn't feel like the right move, right? You got to get this kid to bed. And, you know, you have some leftovers in the fridge. Like, why not just microwave those leftovers and start eating your dinner now, right? So from a highest self perspective, that would be a very sane choice to just swap that out and make that choice, right? A lot of us can feel a food controller energy saying, but that's not what we committed. You know, go the extra mile, slice the onions. And a self-led program can very easily say, settle down, sweetheart. We're going to grab the leftovers out of the fridge. We're going to get this meal into ourselves and move along, right? So that's one example, right? I could give lots of other examples, but a self-led program, you know, this where it gets tricky is if you've got a sponsor saying, well, you know, I don't eat this, 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 or this. I only go to, you know, your Wednesday night meeting is your committed meeting. You have to miss your kid's piano recital because you have to go to your committed meeting. You know, I don't think you should weigh this. You didn't call me 2 days in a row. So now I'm going to call that a break and you're going back to day one. Like these are a bunch of examples of sort of, you know, controller, food controller energy that comes down in these programs. And I sort of shrug and I'm like, well, you know, for me, I look inside, it doesn't feel aligned. It doesn't feel aligned and it doesn't feel helpful. And, you know, so again, the 8 C's of authentic self-living, calm, clear, compassionate, curious, creative, right? This is the energy that if we bring it to our food recovery, we can start to see the need for the bright lines, the clear boundaries, the abstinence approach, while also starting to develop some wisdom around living that as a lifestyle, as a way of life, right? And the self-led program versus the food controller program really becomes obvious at the juncture of real life. And often the distinguishing question is, you know, what are my motives, right? Is my motive to get through this day as sanely and abstinently as possible? Or is my motive to get some more sexy food, you know, because I would prefer eating this or that at this moment. So that's just, I think, you know, I've gone on and on about this, but I really think that the notion of a self-led program is one of the linchpins of being able to do this with happiness and joy and authenticity for decades, right? You've got to make the program work for you.
100%. I want to like jump up and down and just be like, yes, amen. But to end, because we only have a few more minutes, I wonder if this kind of just segues into the other concept that I loved in the book was that crystal vase versus the diamond vase. Will you think you have enough time just to, I think that's like a good ending here about that concept and people can read more about it in your book, but maybe just briefly. Yeah.
Yeah. So a crystal vase is what you get if you come into food recovery and you're abstinent and you're maybe working, you know, your food controller is really happy to finally get the support finally that's needed and you're gripping it tightly. So at some point, if you drop the vase, it shatters. Right. And it never really goes back together the same way again. It's really sad, but you know, the first time around for recovery seems to be a gift. And then often when people lose it, it can be years, just a lot of struggling to get any amount of abstinence back. Now, what happens either when someone has relapsed a bunch and does finally get abstinent again and is able to develop, because of all that pain and experience, a real self-led program, they can develop a diamond vase, or someone never has to relapse and can find their way to a self-led program just through staying abstinent and really, you know, sort of confronting the ghosts and the ghouls of the controller-led program, you know, and saying, I don't really buy into that, right? You can develop a diamond vase, which means it's just as sparkly. It's just, it's not breakable. It's made of a much stronger material. And the way you know is that, you know, you won't be saying things anymore like, you know, if I broke, I don't know if I would ever come back, you know, or get it back, you know, basically it's like, would it be worth it to break? No. If I did, would I, you know, do whatever it took to get my recovery back and get back on track? Yes. You know, and in short order too, because there's no other way for me to live. I have to be abstinent or just my life doesn't work. Right. So in other words, it's, you know, and I think it's fine to have a healthy respect for the disease and to recognize if I broke, I don't know what it would take to get it back because it could be ugly, right? That's sometimes how addiction goes. I don't want to wake up that beast. But ultimately a diamond vase is indestructible, you know, because there's no other place to be but recovery. It's just the only game in town for someone who really genuinely has food addiction. So I guess the diamond vase, you're just not gripping it as tightly, but you're also protecting it just as much because, you know, there nothing good comes from dropping it, really.
And that was like probably one of my biggest takeaways from the book and how that's why I want to live in recovery. Cause I feel like that's true freedom then is that diamond vase. Like that's really true, true freedom. So, thank you so much for talking to us today. Everyone needs to go out and get this book. And you do say too, it's not like we're going to read it once and skim it. I've already read it twice, highlighted, underlined, taken the quizzes. It's more like a workbook, a textbook. Like you're going to go back to it time and time again, and maybe dig in a little deeper here and a little deeper there. So it really is something that you'll be referring to, I think, a lot. Is there anything else today, though, that maybe we just didn't get to, or any just last words of wisdom or advice for people listening that you wanted to share today?
Oh, just to anyone out there who's struggling, just, I love you. I see you. I am you. The food is such a powerful master. And, you know, the book is Rezoom, R-E-Z-O-O-M. And what we didn't get to are the first chapters where I talk about, you know, how food addiction is real. And I go through the 11 criteria in the DSM for a substance use disorder. And I break down how food applies to all of them. And then in the next chapter, I talk about why food addiction is the hardest. If you, you know, and I'm someone who has had crack cocaine addiction, who has had crystal methamphetamine addiction, and food has been harder in my life. And if you're wondering why this thing is so hard, there really are a whole bunch of reasons. I think I outlined 7 of them in the book, why food is the hardest. It is the hardest addiction, and for very good reasons. So just know you're not alone. You're not alone. I love you. I see you. I just am walking with you. And if there's anything I can do to take your hand and help you back onto that path, so here to help, and just sending so much love.
Beautiful. And thank you so much. I mean, not for just all that you do with the Bright, you know, Line Eating community, but also for this book, really shining a light on something that I think a lot of people might be struggling with. And it's just going to be so much relief. So I just thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thanks, Siobhan. Great to talk with you again.
Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day, and remember, life is so much sweeter without sugar.